Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming to the stage cinematographer James Adolphus and director Michael Skolnick. I know there are going to be lots of questions. We were trying to predict the top five when we were together. So let's start with you. I'll repeat the questions for everyone's benefit.
What were your experiences of filming that scene towards the end where they're actually shooting at people? You may actually have been...
You can both talk about this. What were your experiences shooting one of these last scenes when you were being shot at?
I'll let James start with that because we're just talking about that. This is, by the way, this is my partner here. James was with me at all times in Swaziland. And it's a great first question because he did risk his life to get that shot at the end. So I'll let him answer the first one.
I don't really know how to answer the question. I spent some time in other places that were similar to that. I spent some time in Palestine. And Mike saved my life that day, actually. Someone fired a rocket, and because of my experience in the West Bank, I jumped up to run toward the action instead of cowering down behind the dumpster where I was safe. So when I stood up to see who was shooting at us, I didn't see the rocket coming toward my face. So Mike grabbed me and pulled me down, and I still got the shot, or most of it, but I don't know how to answer the question. We sort of hoped that there would be a more of a real opposition to the monarchy, at least I did. And after four trips to Africa, 11 weeks later, a year into it, we got to experience real opposition. And it felt good not to see violence, but to see a large group of people finally come together to stand up and say, enough is enough.
Who's first? I think we'll go in the back and then we'll come to the front. Yes, you, sir.
I just have two questions. First question is, did the kid see the film? What do you think about it? And then the second question is, we saw the princess go through a bit of a change in terms of being, it looks like she's kind of spoiled to, she's realized what's going on. Is that for the cameras or is that the trip she takes, on a yearly basis there? Or was it, based on when you get older, she went there?
So it's a two-part question. First question is, has the king seen the film and what does he think about it? And the second question relates to the princess's transformation that we begin to get a taste of towards the end of the film. And if you can tell us a little bit more about that, if it was, just specifically to her personality at that time.
The king has not seen the film. He will see the film shortly. We'll be going back to Swaziland in the summertime. The princess has seen the film. She's still studying in the States, and I showed it to her about three weeks ago. Just to touch on that, it was a remarkable experience as a filmmaker to show your film to the subject matter where you knew that there were some very hard things for her to see. We had a very open and honest dialogue when the film was over, and she came out of that very inspired, very startled by a lot of the images she saw, and that sort of it goes on to your second question. I remember we were sitting one night at the hotel, and the king and his wives, they trusted me with their children, and the children would come to the hotel often just to sort of hang out because they couldn't really leave the palace. And one night we were at the hotel and we were sitting around, there was a number of princesses and princes sitting at this outdoor table, and we were talking about the problems of Swaziland. And most of them didn't think that they existed. Most of them didn't think that AIDS was such a bad problem, that the poverty was that severe. And Sika Yuso, the princess, would daily ask me, what is it really like? What do they look like? When people were dying of AIDS, what do they look like? Can you touch them? Can you, what do you see them? And over time, I say to her credit, she goes from Princess Paris Hilton to emulating Princess Diana. And I'm really in awe of a young woman in that position who's going through those transformations and asking those questions. That last scene, which you saw in the film, They begged us to take them somewhere. And it's a long story, but I'll give you the short end of it. We were in Swaziland for the last time, and we had this moment set up where we were going to take her to see these young kids. Had no idea what was going to happen. We're just going to take them there. And the king's grandmother passed away. And in Swazi tradition, they have to go into a mourning period until the person is buried. And because it was, I think she died on a Wednesday, they couldn't bury her until like a week and a half. And they can't leave the palace for a week and a half. So we waited for a week and a half until they could come out of the palace. And then the day we were supposed to do this, her mother, the queen, had her family coming in from South Africa, so they were going to cancel it. And we knew this might be the ending of the movie if it turned out the way that it turned out. But when we got there, they were freaked out. I remember driving in the car, and one of her sisters, one of the princesses, says to me, Jablani, which is the name in Zulu, they call me Jablani, where are we? Sebobu is red dirt in Siswati, and that's the place where they go to, and all the roads are red dirt. She said, the roads are red dirt. And I said, we're in Swaziland. And she said, no, we're not. No, it's not Swaziland. Yeah, this is Swaziland. And when we got there, they were so afraid. And I turned to the princess. I just touched them. Just touched them. They didn't even know who you are. Just touched them. And I mean, there's a courageous moment at the end. Honestly, we had no idea that was going to happen. When she touches a young boy who has herpes all over his body. So she, just to give you a quick update, she... We talked a lot after she had screened the film about what she can do next. She's willing to go the distance, and she, this summer, will be taking an HIV test publicly and starting a Know Your Status campaign, which is what they started in Uganda, which brought the raid down in Uganda tremendously, and the king has given her permission to do so. So, you know, I applaud her. She just got back from Swaziland this past weekend. I applaud her madly because I think she's taking a big step.
So I promised that I would take a question that was here. Seems to have moved, so I will go with it. Go ahead.
How do you intend to market your films? Because, you know, I'm pretty amazed that you made this film. I'm not amazed with the princess or any of those people, but I'm really amazed that these young men and other men spoke out so open, because their lives are super at risk. I imagine that things these men disappear in that. So how do you intend to market that in an effective way so that they can
given the risk that some of the villagers and who took part in the rebellion gave of their lives, that, you know, there'll likely be a price on their heads if the king should see them, how do you intend to market the film knowing that sensitive subject matter is there? And how do you intend to do it effectively so that they can mobilize? How will you do it in Africa?
It's an interesting question, and I think it I know it's late, and I don't want to get into a lengthy discussion, but I think it warrants discussion on race and myself, of being a white male, an American white man, making a film in Africa about black people. And this came up earlier today when I saw another film. When you talk to people who don't know that 400 people come watch their movie in Toronto, they don't understand because they don't have that in their country in terms of the outlet of films like this. They do pour their lives, and they do risk their lives. And as a filmmaker, is a tremendous amount of responsibility that I have for them. We discussed with them many of times to cover their faces, to blur their faces. They said no. But again, doesn't mean we shouldn't have, because they may not fully understand what it means once this film does come out. M. Punchlana, who does get arrested, was arrested again last week and got charged again with sedition and is facing the death penalty again. They had a border blockade. This is the second screening of the film. This is the second time from an audience respond to it. It's going to take a lot of deep thought, a tremendous amount of deep thought of how this film gets marketed. I wish I could give you the answer, but I can assure you as an individual and as an audience that I don't take it lightly at all, because this was never a film intended to be made about them. It was actually a film intended to be made about the king. And being close to the king for as long as I have, and being in the country and speaking the language to a certain extent, and people seeing me and seeing James that close to the king, people started coming to my door at 8 o'clock in the morning in my hotel room and and said, Jablani, I got a story for you to tell, and you have to come to Sibovu, and you have to come to Monene, and you have to come here to see how people are living. And, you know, I say this humbly, I could care less if the king is no longer my friend, if he sees this film and thinks that it's against him, because the truth has to be told on both sides. And that country is on the verge of human extinction. It's a very difficult concept as a 28-year-old boy, kid, really, to fully understand and comprehend. We talk, I mean, James made a film in Borneo, and we talk about like the three-legged lizard being extinct in Borneo. But the idea that a group of people, the Swazi people, can become extinct literally in the next 5 to 10 years, I take it very seriously. And I appreciate the question, because I think it's a good one.
Okay, yes. What's the relationship, given the close geographic one, between Swaziland and South Africa, and what kind of influences has South Africa had?
Nelson Mandela's daughter is married to one of Mswati's sisters. And actually Mandela believes is Mswati is actually his king. Thabo Mbeki, who's the current president of South Africa, has a very poor relationship with Mswati. Very, very poor. Thabo was in Swaziland. Swaziland during the apartheid era was a safe haven for many ANC members in South Africa. And Thabo was a young kid. Thabo, South African history, but Thabo's father was a very strong political ANC member. So Thabo was a young kid, was in Swaziland, and was protected by Sobhuza, by the king's father. There was a hit out on Thabo's life, and Sobhuza didn't protect him and almost got Thabo killed. Since that time, Thabo has a hatred for Swaziland. And when Mandela was released from prison, there's a huge section from Swaziland to Johannesburg. It's about, I don't know, it's a 4.5-hour ride, so it's probably, you know, 400 or 500 kilometers, called Mpumalanga. And the Swazis believe it's theirs, and Mandela said he would give it to the Swazis when he was released from prison, and Thabo obviously hasn't fulfilled Mandela's wish. So so as you see, I mean, I'm a student of Southern African politics, but you see with Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, nobody's getting rid of him. And actually, Thabo was coming to Mugabe's aid and sort of protecting him. So they won't get rid of him, Swati. And I said this in the previous screening at the last film festival where we premiered the film in North Carolina, was that if Swaziland had diamonds or Swaziland had oil, I wouldn't be surprised if it was, you know, on our list of axis of evil. And Mswati would be history pretty quickly, but it has no natural resources, very, very little. So it's sort of left to be forgotten about.
I don't want to ignore up top. Okay.
What makes Swaziland unique? Why is the monarchy still surviving there? And this has something to do with the previous question about its relations with outside countries, but what's its relation to colonialism? And second, which may be a related question, why do so many people there apparently speak English?
So it's a two-part question. Firstly, what is unique about Swaziland that a monarchy exists there? And secondly, a little bit about the demographics that so many speak English.
The English question is an easy one because it was a British colony. So English has been taught in Swaziland for, you know, the past 100 years. And most people there speak English. In terms of why it is unique, it's sort of like Cuba. I mean, I've been to Cuba numerous times, and it's, you know, it's one of those countries that's sort of just stuck in time and stays there. As we say in the film, it's the last ruling monarchy in Africa. There are three monarchies in Africa: Lesotho, Morocco, and Swaziland. Lesotho and Morocco are both constitutional. Swaziland's only absolute. It's a good question of why they've been able to hold on to what they've held on to. But if you look around them, Mozambique was, you know, Marxism, and South Africa was apartheid, and Botswana and Zimbabwe, and they've all gone through so many civil wars, and that was sort of the reason why you put that civil war segment in there to show that Africa is dealt with so many civil wars, and Swaziland has not gone through it. But they, you know, it's part of it is the monarchy and the way that it's set up. One of the reasons why he marries so many wives and why Sibuza had 110 was they picked them from different, I don't want to call them clans because it's a bad word, but it's, for lack of a better word, clans from different clans around Swaziland. So they won't fight with each other, different chiefdoms. So if he has a wife from this chiefdom and a wife from this chiefdom, then they won't fight with each other because they're both sort of related. So they figured out a good way, a good sort of balance to control the people. And Swazis in general are very peaceful people. And one thing James was saying was that they don't fight, unlike South Africans who went, you know, to violence to combat apartheid, and rightfully so. But they don't. And I think this film shows, and I think now is the moment when it could break, and it could turn to a fight.
Yes. Excellent question. The first question that we thought was going to come. How is it that you got so close to the king?
I studied Zulu at university, at UCLA in Los Angeles. And it was a class of two in a school of 37,000 students. When you go to university, you think there's 500 kids in your class, and there's two of us. And the teacher, and I always had a sort of fascination for South Africa growing up and being a kid of the 80s, you know. And my ignorance and my childness of the 80s, you know, my reference to the Kings was, you know, Eddie Murphy and James Earl Jones is coming to America, right? So when my professor walked in, he said, you know, I'm from Swaziland, there's a king in Swaziland. I said, what? Like, kings? Eddie Murphy? Who? And I love the man, and that's the film's in memory of him. And he turned out to be an advisor to the king. And the first time I met the king, I crawled on my hands and my knees. And he actually says, this was 1999. I was in Swaziland for the first time, and he had just got a DVD player. And it's his birthday, it was his 30th birthday, he wanted DVDs. So I brought him Coming to America. He said it's about his favorite movie. So he had asked me in the past few years to make a film about him. And I said, sure. And as we talked earlier, I wanted to make a film. It's really an academic sort of film about what it is for the last ruling king. And then when I got there, when we got there, shit hit the fan. And I couldn't. I just couldn't tell this one side, but I may not be that close anymore. So
Eddie Murphy has touched so many lives. Okay, right in the back row. You.
Now, if Princess doesn't know about the actual life in their country, what king knows about the country and what he actually does for his people, or we know.
So if the princess knows so little about what's actually happening in her country, how much could the king possibly know, and what could he possibly be doing for his people?
I think it's a good question for all of us to sort of ask as we leave. I remember sitting in New York City in a hotel room with the king, not, you know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago. He was speaking at the UN. It was 3 a.m, it was just me and him. And I was, you know, no one really, you don't. It's very protocol with the king, and you know, when the guards are gone, very candid with him, very sort of straightforward with him. And I said, you know, let's go to the club. We're in New York, it's 3 a.m, let's go to the club. He's like, okay, let's go. And he said, thought about it. And he said, I can't. And I said, why not? So they'd recognize me. I said, come on. I said, put on a baseball hat and put on like a jacket, and you know, the black guy in New York, right? Like, let's be real. Say, no, they're gonna recognize me. I need Secret Service. And I thought about it, and would I have gone to the club with the king? Absolutely. But was my intention to go to the club with him? No, I just wanted to see what he would say if he would leave that hotel room on the 52nd floor of the St. Regis. And I thought about it, and I thought, he's been this way since he was 12 years old, and he's been guarded like this since he was 12 years old. There's no excuse. I'm not making any excuses for him, but all he knows is what it is to be a king. He knows, he's very well aware when he goes out to see things. Like this morning they opened a hotel in Sidege, which is a small town, and he opened it. He knows when he goes to Sidege this morning that they make it beautiful for him. He knows that. He knows that when they pave the roads when he arrives, and it's probably not paved before he got there. What can he do about it? He can do a lot about it. What is he going to do about it? We'll see. I mean, I think this when he sees this film, as much as he may not like it, I think that deep down inside, when he goes to sleep that night, he will say, "Holy cow." Because nobody wants to believe your country's 42.6% positive. Nobody. Nobody wants to believe. When we talk about Sudan and Darfur, we had an interview with the head of the World Food Program in Swaziland, which we didn't use, but he was in Sudan. And he said, and he knows better than I do, he says this is just as bad as Sudan in terms of the poverty level. And the only reason why the world doesn't look at it is because they're classified as a middle-income country, because you have a billionaire at top, and you have a million people who live below a dollar a day. And think about it, if you got $1 billion for a million people, you're far better than Sudan, than Chad, than Niger, than Sierra Leone, and you just get leveled off at $1,200 a person per capita, and everyone forgets about you and they think you're fine. And that's the biggest tragedy, is that no one will take out that billionaire and then look at everybody else who are, you know, starving, like the Southern Sudanese or the people in Chad.
Sadly, Michael, we are out of time. We are out of time, but I know that the two of you will be more than happy to keep talking outside, because you're great talkers. Don't forget to mark your ballots.